Hi, my name is Michael Poli, and I've never seen Buffy the Vampire Slayer. My friends are obsessed and always make jokes and references to it. And so now, 20 years later, I've been convinced to watch the show from beginning to end, one episode a week. I'm a Buffy virgin. All right, well, welcome to another episode of Buffy Virgin. This is season 1, episode 12. We are finally getting to the end of this incredible television series, at least for season 1 of the series here. Hold on a second.
Who knows if they're going to make another season?
At this point, it's hard to know.
This is the Buffy virgin. He doesn't know. This might be a one-season show. He doesn't know.
We made it. We made it all the way.
Yeah. Amazon knows the truth, and they've revealed to me that there are 10 seasons of this show. Which is, it seems insane at this point. I don't know how they're going to keep this up for 10 seasons. But this was an episode. Let me talk about who's on the show right now. So my name is Michael. I'm the virgin. We've got Dr. Travis with us.
Hi. Hi, Buffyverse. How are you doing?
We've got Dennis, a cartoonist and Buffy enthusiast.
Hey, glad to be here. Sorry I missed last week.
Terrible. And then John, an educator.
Yeah, good evening.
So we're going to talk about this episode, and then we're also going to go through all of the episodes in kind of a season. We're gonna just give our opinions. We have a couple questions that we've put together about the season 1 in its totality, and we're going to go through it and pick out some of our favorite episodes, best moments, scariest monsters, in addition to just the stuff that we'll go over for this episode, and then we'll make predictions about what will happen in season 2. I will make predictions based on season 2, and other people will laugh at how foolish these assumptions are based on what's already happened. So the episode we're talking about tonight is season 1, episode 12, Prophecy Girl. It was written and directed by Joss Whedon, and it originally aired in June 2nd, 1997. So almost 20 years ago, 19 years ago, 19 and a half at this point. So I just want to talk through these different acts. So we kind of agreed on the act breaks for this episode. So this episode, it's the Prophecy Girl, and it's the closer for the season. So there's a lot of stuff they have to get done to make this work. So season 1 opens at the Bronze. Xander practicing his how he's going to ask Buffy out on Willow. It's a fun little scene. And we cut from there to Buffy fighting vampires. And then meanwhile, Giles is looking at the Codex, and there's an earthquake that takes place. And we see the earthquake play out in every one of these scenes. And then we cut to the Master in his underground lair, and he's thrilled. He could not be more thrilled. So that's kind of the opener for this episode. So anybody want to talk about the opener?
Did you mention there was an earthquake?
I did mention that there was an earthquake.
Yeah. Okay, sorry. I felt really bad for Willow in the being practiced on scene.
Yeah.
Didn't Xander already ask Buffy out? Haven't we already dealt with this? I'm shocked that we're still hitting the same theme again.
Hold on, because it's going to keep happening.
Yeah, because I felt like this has already happened. Yeah, and it's terrible for, it's another dance. How many dances have there been? Now it's Spring Fling. Didn't we just last episode have another dance that was going to happen?
It seemed like that was already their prom, and this is another spring-themed prom. May Queen and Spring Fling.
They kind of joke about that a little bit in this episode where Buffy's mom is like, oh, well, we called it prom, Spring Fling, whatever.
Yeah. I have a question about the scene in the cemetery where Buffy basically just killed a vampire. First of all, is this Cordelia? This is a new boyfriend for Cordelia, right? This is not the same one from the last episode. Is that correct?
No, it couldn't possibly be. Was that Mitch in the last episode?
This is Kevin. This guy's name is Kevin. The last one was Mitch.
I got one episode as well, it turns out.
Yeah, Mitch is.
So I just want
to. And we don't hear from him again.
Yeah, I want to clear that up. Okay.
People who go to the hospital, that's gross.
And then.
Can we talk about thematically how this fight scene is so interestingly similar to the previous fight scene last episode where she's doing slow mo. In the Bronze, she's fighting in slow motion, and this scene starts out with slow motion. Also, it looks fantastic as well. So
it does look fantastic.
Yeah, I really like that scene where she pulls out the stake and the vampire goes there smiling to upset. Like,
yeah, well, here's
my that's the whole season right there. That's like, that's here's the pitch. I feel like Prefs, I'm going to talk about this a lot, but I think Prefs the Girl stands as like a, not only like as a single episode, but maybe as like the full, a full season in itself. Like, that's just like, you can just watch this episode and it'll explain what Buffy is about.
Agreed.
And that slow-mo thing is like, in minute detail, showing like, oh, she looks like an helpless girl, but she does a freaking flip, and she's a, and she's actually the killer of the monsters.
But the whole slow-mo shot is of her like kind of being thrown across the park, and she gets, she falls on her back really hard, right? Yeah. And then the very next shot, she pulls the stake out from her, the back of her shirt, which is just like, did you not just fall on that? Like, I just feel like she would have gotten poked. I don't know. It's just a, maybe it's not important.
I was also going to, because this is a directed by Joss Whedon episode, and I wanted to point out, it's weird he's a great action director now, or he's mostly an action director, because, like, directing fight scenes is does not come naturally to him.
I think you can tell when you see the green screen moments from the Avengers, where everyone's just doing random shit, and then they're figuring it out later in post, what they're doing. Yeah. I don't think he's necessarily a great fight scene director. The Avengers.
Yeah, I didn't mean to say great. I meant it's weird that he is a big action director now, because it's not his natural forte.
Well, I'll say this: is this episode? I think I feel that all the best action is actually slow or not action at all. Like, my whole feeling about this whole episode is that things happen either way too fast or way too slow. Although I'm a big fan of the episode. For instance, I think. This is actually the one scene that works really well, because I don't know, for some reason, when you slow down all this crazy stuff that happens, this slow-mo like works better than all this other sort of fast action at the very end of the episode, which is chaotic and crazy and very traditional, but it's too much. And then other scenes of violence that work really well are, there's no action. There's just the remnants of violence in this episode. So I don't know. I thought that this graveyard scene was a very like, I don't know. It was like kind of pitch perfect. Buffy season one was this scene, because it combined Buffy, the vampire, Cordelia, and I don't know, Cordelia's a little more interesting in this scene for a little, even though she's in the car. She's like kind of, I don't know, it's just interesting.
No, I think it is like you're saying, prototypical. Like, this is probably the season in one episode. Like, that, even that opening is, it's a Whedon cut where they're like, I wonder what Buffy's up to. Well, probably nothing. And then they cut usual. To her, you know, the usual, that's right. And then we cut her fighting vampires, and she's already killed three in one night.
Yeah. I say the problem with this episode is there's too much stuff that happens. It should be a double episode. And because there's too much stuff that happens, they don't do justice to all the stuff that happens. That's my complaint with this episode. They're cramming like two episodes into one.
I mean, we could talk about this more at the end, but I'd say they're more. It's more than that. It's an entire season arc.
Yeah, it's like three or four episodes worth of stuff that happens.
But I mean, to me, it works, and I'm like, why doesn't every season do this instead of having like, I mean, too many shows you're just watching. You're just the arc goes on way too long, and this is like, oh, an actual full story in one episode. Like,
so thank God. My biggest complaint is a series I just tried to watch. I watched kind of, was Jessica Jones. Uh-huh. So, very Buffy inspired, actually. We can talk about that some other time. My problem with Jessica Jones was 12 episodes happen, and they're all, I think there's 12, or there's like a lot, 10, 11, 12, I don't remember. And they're all like long, because there's no commercial breaks. They're like 45 to 50 minutes. But like nothing happens. There's not even like any, within the individual episodes, there's no good like single stories. Buffy have, whether you'd have 12 episodes, you have a lot of different stories. This was literally the same story through the whole thing. I actually had to just, at the third episode, say, this is too slow. And I just looked and said, did they kill the, oh, spoiler alert. If you've never seen Jessica Jones.
Well, yeah, no Buffy spoilers. Yeah, but, no Buffy, you know, Jessica Jones, go for it.
Don't spoil this.
And I just had, we will not spoil the show. It's been out for 20 years, but one that's been out for what, 6 months?
Yeah, let's ruin it.
Yeah, who cares about that? I was like, yeah, they finally kill, or they're supposed to kill David Tennant. Never, but it took 12 hours to kill him, and it wasn't like she had to get some new superpower. He had the superpower from the first episode.
Yeah. It wasn't like somebody on another podcast described Netflix original series as being like an entire season is just the pilot episode. Like, definitely true for Daredevil. I mean, the entire first season for him to put on a costume finally. That's so annoying.
I was wondering how do you keep writing zero action and zero dialogue for 12 episodes?
Can I say, like, this is why I have a problem watching television shows, because they're exhausting and they have so much of, they want so much attention for you to even get through them. And people are like, oh my gosh, Jessica Jones or Daredevil is so great. And it's like, cool, I'm going to watch 12 hours and it's like a little bit will happen. It's this crazy big ongoing story. So I really like Jessica Jones, but I totally agree with what you're saying, Travis. Like,
but that's my big difference when I talk about Buffy. At least shit happens in each individual episode. You have like the weird. You have like at least you have little shit that happens. Sure, the big plot with the master.
Little shits.
Yeah, at least you have like. Okay,
I can't wait to go into this. Let's save this conversation for the end, because I talk in great detail about the shit that happens in this show. Let me just rein it in a little bit here.
We're still on the teaser at the beginning.
I do want to talk about too.
One last thing for this episode, this scene with Buffy and Cordelia. The importance of this is in the graveyard. Joss Whedon is showing there's two worlds that coexist, both real and important. That's my take on that scene. You have to realize there's two worlds, and that's what this whole series is about: the two worlds that exist. Okay. Buffy's world and the real world. The world of love and all those things. And
so I just wanted to comment on the skylight in the third year. Library has a skylight that we've never seen before. And how silly, like how big the library felt, but I think it's a redesigned library to include this skylight prop, which, you know, they make use of later, but it was very strange. And I don't understand how big the library was. And then, but not only that, but like, it's so pitch perfect. Giles reads the prophecy aloud, or like to himself, and then immediately an earthquake happens, like it's connected. And I found that to be quite silly, but it made me laugh. Let's move into Act 1. So Act 1 is kind of about the prophecy.
I'm going to try to shut this dog up. I'll just be a second.
Whatever it takes.
Hey, cut it out. Come here.
I think this makes the final cut.
Come here, buddy. All right, out you go.
This is our intro.
Let's start with.
You guys listen to episode 3.
We start with the spoiler to Jessica Jones. That's what we start with. It's the spoiler to Jessica Jones. No warning.
Also, I think they intended to like the end of the season almost.
Yeah, it
like,
takes fucking forever.
You said it hasn't happened like in episode 3.
No. I said I waited till episode 3 and said, when is this guy going to die? Because nothing happened. And then I'm like, I have to invest 12 hours for him to die? Nothing happens in that show. And I'm
now he's scratching at the door. God damn it.
Dog loves you.
Did you electrify the door?
No barking. Sorry, guys. Barking. This is not my dog.
Oh,
this is some other dog.
Different dog.
Yeah. It's the opposite of my dog, actually. Here. Come here. It's because Mosey's big and black, and this is small and white.
Oh.
Entire opposite.
Is that why it's so loud?
Yeah.
So you live in a house with strange dogs. Well, what a strange world.
Yeah, there's a dog I've never talked about.
It's
my dad's girlfriend's dog.
So I'll jump in Act 1. This is the prophecy act where we learn about. We've learned about the prophecy in the previous episode. There is a prophecy. There's a codex. Angel was able to get it, and Giles is reading from it in the opening. So it opens with Buffy walking to the library. She's wondering what's going on. Is the library structurally sound? Are we safe? There was a huge earthquake, a 5.1. A 5.1 is a pretty big earthquake on the scale of earthquakes. I don't know if anybody did any Googling about this, what a 5.1 can do damage-wise. John's raising his hand.
Not on that specifically. I wanted to know if Xander and Willow did the right thing hiding under the staircase at the Bronze. And it seems like not really. I couldn't find any specific.
Desk. In the school, you hide under a desk.
Under a staircase.
They used to say you hid in doorways, but they don't say that anymore.
Right.
That's exactly. Old info.
Yeah, Giles did that though. Giles went to the doorway.
Last time I was in an earthquake, I tried to go to a doorway, but I went to a porch. Which I then was like, oh, this is dangerous.
at least you didn't go to a balcony.
And We don't know for sure.
I mean, it was a balcony. Sorry. It was a balcony. Anyway.
Bless her quick. I opened up the window. It fell out.
Yeah. Last time I was in an earthquake, it was the Philadelphia earthquake. So it was fine.
Ooh, I was underground during an earthquake once. That was scary.
Oh, me too. I was in Pirates of the Caribbean during an earthquake once.
Ooh.
Whoa.
Did the pirates come alive and eat the tourists?
Yep. When the Pirates of the Caribbean break down, the pirates eat the tourists. That's that famous quote.
Oh, we have to rip all this out.
Except that I remember an earthquake happening, feeling an earthquake in Ohio when I was a kid. And that seems impossible.
Oh, I remember. No, I remember that. I didn't feel it, but I remember people talking about it.
It must have been an underground missile test.
It was a very subtle earthquake.
Well, your parents must have told you it was a missile test.
I remember hearing about it.
So there's this earthquake, and are we safe? And Giles is like, yeah, everything's safe.
Yeah, I like Buffy keeps saying things that sound like she knows about her death. Like, are we safe in here? Is this where I'm going to die?
Oh, yeah. No, the whole scene is about, we know that there's a prophecy that's bad, and it probably involves Buffy dying. And then Buffy's just hinting that she's about to die as a joke. Like, she doesn't understand it. It's a cute scene. Vampire attacks are getting more frequent. She talks about the vampires she killed. And then she says at the end, she's like, I have to meet my terrible fate. And Giles is like, oh! And she's like, biology class. You know, it's such a goofy scene. It feels like a season one, episode one scene. Like, it feels like people finding their characters and saying them really loudly, like how, you know, being very clear about their direction.
So what is that called when the audience knows like something bad is going to happen, but the character doesn't? What's that called in like a show? I feel like it has a name. I'll figure it out.
There probably is a name. That sounds like when we have slightly more information than the characters about what will happen. It's probably all entertainment is based around that principle. I don't know.
I mean, sometimes, but other times it's, you know, you're in the dark like the characters.
It's probably like everything except thrillers. When you watch a thriller, oh, no, thrillers, you totally know more, right? You know something bad's going to happen.
You know, all kinds of
stuff. You know they're in a thriller and they don't. They think they're living a life.
Just living my life. But then so we saw someone like a shadowy figure run across the scene. So then we cut to the guys. The gang, rather, they're, you know, Xander, Buffy, Willow, they're coming back from a test. And this is the most, this is like the roughest scene in the episode, in my opinion, where we watch Xander ask Buffy out, and it's excruciating to watch this scene happen in real time as we see Xander struggle with the words and then finally say the words and then gets rejected, which is not a shock to all of us, but it's a shock to him. And he feels incredibly sorry for himself throughout this episode. And it's terrifying. It's frustrating. Then we cut to Giles. He's on the phone, and the cyber witch character from an earlier episode,
Jenny Calendar.
From Jenny Calendar, she shows up from the iRobot Eugene episode.
We also solve a mystery about why everyone calls Giles Giles. Right? No one calls him Mr. Giles, really, or Rupert. Even the kids call him Giles. He, on the phone, says, this is Giles!
I did notice that.
Mystery freaking solved.
I did not even know that there was a mystery. So.
Like, this is Giles. Rupert Giles. It's just like, that's why everyone calls him Giles. He's like a last name guy.
So Jenny Calendar shows up. She's been surfing the net lately, looking for unexplained incidents. And she has a lot of them. There was a boy who's born with his eyes facing inward. There was the earthquake, obviously.
The cat gave birth to snakes. That was my favorite.
Yeah, I wrote that down. I want to hear Dr. Frog explain how that could happen.
Do you mind?
Well, I didn't do my residency on a hell mouth, so I guess anything is possible. But
are you sure?
That's a good point. Oh, I had a vampire-related story. That will come at the end.
It comes whenever you want.
Yeah.
Like at work?
No, it was just like a personal, cursed vampire story. Well, I'll bring it up at the end. Roman.
Yes, please.
Listeners, stay tuned until the end of the podcast when Travis will reveal his vampire story.
Oh, and the best line ever in Buffy Okay, the best line Jenny Callender, that actress, will ever say, ever in her career, is this line. Look, Rupert, I helped you cast a demon out of the internet. I hope that merits some trust.
So, I liked her Some Crazy Monk line better.
Well, come on. Well, yeah. That was good.
So Jenny, she wants to help. She knows something's up. And then Giles knows more and doesn't want to say, doesn't want to tell her what the about the prophecy or the codex. And she and Jenny mentions the monk, this crazy monk, Brother Luca, who she got an email from, and he's been mailing out about some crazy stuff. And then Giles is like, yeah, please look into that. And then get back to me and I'll tell you more. okay. It's crazy how untrustworthy he is. But in the same time, you know, he kind of blows it later. So it sounds like that's what she's going to do. The next scene, we cut to Cordelia and her new boy that she was with earlier. It's Kevin. They're going to set up for the dance. She asks Willow to help set up the sound system for the next day.
And Ron does not have their own PA or their own sound tech.
They do, but they won't let the school kids use it.
That's a good explanation.
I want to know the explanation, though, for why you go to Willow, because she's a nerd, but she's not a sound nerd. Like, surely somebody in this school.
Yeah, to Cordelia, it's all the same.
Yeah, okay.
Can I say this, though, about being a nerd is how, like, people just assume you can do everything. So, like, I work in video production, right? Like, and people think that I know everything about video and audio hardware, and as it applies to different types of systems. I'm good at organizing and producing video content at, like, short form video content. That does not mean I know how to set up, a video conferencing system. It does not mean I know what speakers or headphones are the best for you, because we all want different things. And it doesn't mean that like I'm the general AV tech for our organization.
Oh yeah, dude. It
constantly happens where people are like, oh man, there's an AV problem. Like, okay, I am busy on a shoot. I cannot possibly be involved in your AV problem. That is another job. That's like a maintenance guy job.
Totally. I'm the computer teacher, and people are like, I've got an idea for a social network app about sneakers. Can you help me make it? And I'm like, no.
I would figure the most annoying thing.
First you demand to watch the movie Sneakers with them and see.
I don't think that's what he meant. I'd like to think that it was a social network only for fans of the movie Sneakers.
Or for people who sneak around.
Wait, that was great. Let's do some research on this first, guys.
Oh, yeah. But
well, my friend, generally, if you got you help me wear a wire that one day. Yeah.
I mean, look, now, the worst part, I bet somebody comes into your classroom, John, and it's like, hey, I'm not getting Wi-Fi. The internet's
all the time.
You teach computers, right? You must know how the network works with the Symantec stuff, right?
And, well, here's the frustrating thing is that I kind of do know the answer to their question, but it's not my job. So, like, I have to be like, I know how to help you, but I won't.
You can't enable those people. You can't enable them. It's so easy.
I know. Yep. So easy.
So Willow is enabling Cordelia to mistreat nerds for the rest of her life.
Well, she is distracted.
But then Willow goes to see Xander, who is moping about how Buffy doesn't want to date him, and then decides to flip it on its head and invite Willow to the dance instead. And this is so awesome. Love Willow for this. She's like, I don't want to go to dance with you and just see you mope about Buffy. And it's exactly the right advice at the right time. Because this could have gone a lot of different ways. And I was so happy with the way that scene gets handled. And it's like, this is the moment I love Willow the most, when she shuts down this bullshit. It's great.
Yeah, I love that depiction too. I feel like typically in high school stories, in John Hughes movies, I guess, like the depiction of a crush, you experience totally through the crusher's point of view. Right, like if this was a John Hughes movie, we'd be completely on Xander's side, and we wouldn't really think about Willow's feelings at all, and it would just be excited for Xander, or sorry for Xander, whatever the case may be. But the way that it's presented, like, you're not on Xander's side at all. You're kind of annoyed with him for being so self-absorbed. And this comes up, it's a minor, very minor spoiler, but there's another episode, Buffy episode, that I think connects with this, where one character, I won't say who, describes another character's crush as selfish, and uses the word selfish to describe a crush, or to describe, sort of an obsessive crush. And I think that is a really cool way to present that and to talk about that. And it's really, really different than how we normally do it in stories like this. You think about, like, Say Anything and, like,
holding the boom box up, and it's presented as romantic, but really, in this case, it's really just sort of self-absorbed.
Well, thank God John Hughes isn't directing this show, because this would be a very different show.
So can, do you guys think that Willow's lines in this scene were dubbed over later?
I didn't notice. Do you think it was?
So the reason I ask is her voice in this scene is so amazing. It's so different. Like it's like her like the way her voice sounds is the best. It's actually the best delivery of any line in this episode. Basically, I think she just sounds so different. She's so mature sounding. It just, there's no way you think that I want to go to the dance with you and see you wishing you were with Buffy. That's just like the way she said, it wasn't like that high pitch she normally has. So I thought maybe they dubbed it over later. It just sounds like amazing. Like the clarity, the tone, everything.
Oh, it just felt like a really mature character. I mean, especially in contrast to earlier where Buffy was kind of flippant with her lines and like kind of felt like she was still finding the character. I feel like Willow is pretty developed.
Yeah. Well, and it's also a big change just within the episode. In the first scene, she's like, she literally has the line of, you can practice on me more. Like,
I know. I didn't like that scene because it was so awful in that sense.
But like you really buy the 180 from Willow because like it's a 180 and there's nothing in between to say why she's changed the way she's approaching it. But you buy it because Willow is a well drawn out character and she's a well acted character, and you go with it because you can appreciate both sides of that coin, because you can relate to both the desire to want to, you know, have contact with the person you like, or, you know, like to play into them, or to keep telling them what they want to hear in order to be around them. But you can also completely identify with and really be proud of when she says that, no, I won't be around you anymore when you're doing this.
No.
Yeah, I was so proud of Willow in that scene.
Yeah. Her scene exists only to set up the scene with Buffy and Xander. I don't like that. It's too expeditious.
Well, there's so many setup scenes in this episode. Like, if you're talking about setup scenes, like the moment where Willow's being asked to check on AV equipment is just a setup scene for horrific scene. Like,
totally.
Yeah.
The scene where Willow and Cordelia are in the hallway just talking about AV shit, that's a setup for the massacre scene.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's
totally. Yeah, lots of setup scenes. Yeah.
So then we cut to, you know, Buffy. She's going to the bathroom. It seems late at night. But anyway, she's going to the bathroom and there's blood in the sink, which is a totally horrific apocalyptic event. Then she rushes to the library to talk to Giles about it. And Angel and Giles are arguing. And that tomorrow night she learns that she is supposed to die, killed by the master. We fade to black, open on act two.
Yay.
So any other thoughts here about act one? I feel like we've really hit everything.
I think we did a good, I think I've watched this episode. This is the first episode this season where I feel like I've watched it so many times that, like, the other episodes this season, I'd kind of always skipped or maybe watched part of or whatever. So this one, I feel like I've seen it so many times in different stages of my life. Because I feel like I used to relate more to the Xander, his obnoxious, like, behavior than I do now. And maybe I've actually watched it right after being rejected by somebody for some reason, you know? So it's just interesting. I feel like I can see all sides of it better. Because what he does is selfish, but I totally relate to him doing it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. It's not a condemnation of him, but it is sort of like a sober look at what that's like, right?
Yeah. The shot of like Buffy looking like going from smiling to sad as he asks her out and is like, dude, are you doing this? Like,
yeah,
that was some good acting also. Not as good as the Willow acting, but
I'm super surprised that Buffy didn't see it coming sooner because he has not been subtle.
Yeah. He also randomly bullies some dude. He's like, leave.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is another cool thing about this, about Buffy, is that like, no matter how much our characters are the underdogs in the social hierarchy, there are always people lower than them, which I think is a nice detail.
Yeah.
I mean, that totally is like episode 11, episode just before this, all over again to see that kind of shit. They clearly learned nothing from that
episode. Yeah. No, they can't. They can't learn anything.
That guy's going around the corner and turning invisible right now. That's what's happening.
I was just bullied by Xander Harris.
I I do have a very small question related to that, is that Xander does say that he's had a lot of practice with rejection, and I kind of feel like that's not true. I mean, he's been pining for Buffy as long as we've seen him, and he has all these like little horn dog moments, but he hasn't made any actual attempts to date anybody ever.
That's not true. That's not true.
Cordelia.
He tries to sex that mantis teacher.
That's true.
He tries to sex her good.
He wasn't rejected at all by the mantis teacher. That was the problem. If he had been rejected by the mantis teacher, he would be fine.
But there was also the, you know, the pre, but the, I think he was after Cordelia for many, many years and was rejected.
Is that implied that he wants to date Cordelia?
I think he hates Cordelia at this point, right?
Yeah, I think everything he says is that he hates her, and I could see that being that he wants to date her, but I don't read from that that he was explicitly rejected at any point.
Jesse was rejected. Maybe maybe when Jesse died in his arms, he absorbed all of his rejections.
Oh, is it like Highlander when like someone dies, you like absorb their rejection?
Quote. Yeah,
there can be. No, he definitely is into Cordelia, like 100% of the season.
No, he's not.
No. He doesn't want to do the interviews with her, you know, when they're investigating.
Oh my god, have you ever met someone that you were...
Dude, he's...
That's exactly what you do. You do that. That's what you say. It's like,
you know what, that would be a more realistic direction for Buffy to go, is for Xander to fall in with Cordelia based on his, like, ugh, Cordelia, she's the worst. Like, that would make the most sense for that to happen, but the way the show plays it, like, there's no chemistry happening between the two of them. But it is believable, like realistically, for that to happen. But in the show world, that would never happen. It's Xander versus Angel in Xander's mind, even though Buffy was never considered by either of them as to be even a competitor. In fact, it's crazy when Angel discovers that Xander likes Buffy. He's like, oh, you love her too, huh? You love her?
That's just a terrible scene anyway.
There's a lot of terrible scenes in this episode. But let's move on here to Act 2, start Act 2.
With one of the best scenes of the episode.
It actually is a really good scene, and it's really hard to summarize this scene because there's so many interesting, weird statements from Buffy about her role as a slayer here, where she just wants, she finds out that the prophecy is that she's going to die, so she wants to quit. I don't want to be a slayer anymore, and then there's no prophecy. Like, you know, she has no responsibility. And, like, Angel and Giles both tell her, like, you can't do that. That doesn't work. You can't just quit. You know, it's not an option. And she's like, she takes her necklace off, you know, that Angel had given her, you know, this, she takes off the cross. It's like, no, I'm 16 and I don't want to die. Like she's bargaining for her life with the two of them. And it's a really powerful, sad scene where you really empathize with Buffy and what's going on with her life. Then we cut to another character.
We got to keep talking about that scene. There's a couple things on that scene.
Please.
One, the silver cross makes a comeback. I was insane about this in the first episode, and it makes a very dramatic comeback in this episode, which I'm happy about. Number two, I have a couple of gripes. So this scene actually embodies. So get ready for a second, because this scene embodies the whole premise of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the show. This scene, and this was present in episodes 1 and 2, where she showed up at the new school and she did not want to be the Buffy the Vampire. She didn't want to be the Vampire Slayer. And this is why this scene, because I mean this is we've done 12 episodes, nothing has changed. That's one of the central problems for this character, is that 12 episodes ago or 11 episodes ago, this was the exact same problem, and here we are, season 1, episode 12. I don't want to die. I don't want to die. So you're gonna tell. So I'm 16 years old. I don't want to die. So I mean this, and there's no answer to this. So the problem with this scene with Angel and Giles are twofold. Angel's acting is just way too flat. There's no emotion in him in this scene for some reason. Number two criticism of Giles, he's looking off camera. He won't look at her. I think somebody thought that would work. But that doesn't really work for me in this scene. Number two problem with Giles, he's wearing a striped shirt and a striped tie. It looks insane. Like, it's just too much stripes. It doesn't look visually normal. Like, it's distracting.
I would wear that outfit.
Yeah, but it doesn't look good on camera. That's what I'm trying to say.
The note I wrote for this scene was, this one scene, better than 50 years of Spider-Man comics.
This is a superhero rejecting their superpowers. I mean, this is the raison d'etre of this whole series is, I'm a superhero, I don't want to fucking be a superhero because I'm a line of superheroes who fucking die. That's the situation.
And
because, but it's all because of prophecy too. And prophecies are so stupid.
Well, listen, we can talk about prophecies, my man.
Yeah.
I think you've been foretold. You know, that's a,
it's just the stupidest version of history is the version that's foretold from a prophecy. That's just, it's an absurd, simplistic version of reality. And it bothers me because clearly they didn't read the next paragraph in this prophecy. But anyway.
Well, I think the setup kind of in the Buffyverse, this is maybe the first time they have prophecies, but that
this is the first time
they're riddles, right? That like reveal half truths or whatever. They're all about their fucking tricks.
I mean, that's not Buffy. That's like, that's how prophecies work. That's Oedipus. That's Macbeth. Is that there's the prophecy, but you didn't read the fine print. That constantly happens.
I mean, I don't know. So to me, this episode is like everything you haven't resolved in 11 episodes. This scene fucking happens, and then the rest of the episode needs to deal with this scene, and they kind of do, but...
this is the executive producer scene where it's like, look, you got to resolve this. This show might not happen anymore. Well, how are you going to deal with it?
But this is like what you... This is what, like... Yeah, I don't know. What I'm trying to say is maybe after 11 episodes, you would either hope that you weren't still addressing the same issue or address this issue in a really awesome way. Because that's like the whole problem with this... this is the reason why Buffy's like special. And so I love this scene. This is hands down number two scene of the episode, but probably one of the best scenes of this in the entire series.
Also, yeah, it's a good scene. I think it's important that she points out her age. Like,
yes,
these characters are so dealing with responsibilities so heavily and stuff, and it is like, yeah, they're supposed to be 16. Like, 16-year-olds really can't handle this.
So things I would change.
Damn it, dog! Stop licking me.
I would have Giles look at Buffy. I would have him hold something. He needs a prop. I'd have him change shirts and change ties.
Holding something doesn't fix all your problems.
He had some problems in this scene. I would have Buffy actually hit him with the book. Or actually break a window and then break another window. She throws the book at a wall, and we all know that like she could have hit Giles if she wanted. I almost feel like she should have hit Giles, and because she hits him later on, and it works really well. So I would have had her hit him also as well with a book, or something, or just destroyed a bookshelf. I mean, it's all going to get destroyed anyways this episode. But and then Angel should have like been closer physically.
But she was all like, "Don't touch me!" Like,
yeah, he should try to touch. He actually should have tried to hold her in this scene. Whatever. I'm done.
We can move on now.
You can move on.
So we cut from that scene to Xander feeling really sorry for himself and listening to country music. Dennis, okay?
Yeah, I'm fine. The dog knocked over my phone.
Classic.
Get your homework.
He might. Get up.
So Xander's feeling sorry for himself, and then Buffy is also feeling sorry for herself, but in a more meaningful way, mental, and looking through the photos of her life. And then Joyce, you know, her mom steps in and says, and Buffy, like, in this really crazy makeup, I don't know what they did lighting-wise, so that when she turns to look at her mom, she looks crazy. Like, let's get away. Let's get out of here. Let's leave. But, you know, Joyce is like, you know, you can't. Can't leave. Sorry, the museum's open. You know, we got a life. You know, we can't move on. We can't escape.
Joyce totally misreads what she said about terrible parenting jobs. Yes. Yeah. Anyway, sorry. Keep going.
So Joyce thinks that she's sad because she can't go to the dance and that the right guy didn't ask her. And so she's bought her a dress and then tells this, you know, kind of weird story that she, you know, implies that there's a crazy story there, how she met her husband, you know, Buffy's dad, at a dance, like the dance that Buffy's going to tonight, and it's important that she go to the dance. So it's clearly like, this dance is super important to Joyce. This is how I met my husband. Something like that could happen to you, Buffy, which is why I went all out and bought this ridiculous dress for you, to have this really meaningful opportunity. And then, you know, Buffy ultimately, you know, she is excited about the dress, and she's like, well, maybe I do need to do this. And go alone.
This scene really made me think about something you said, Mike, about how in Buffy and in life, the older generation reacts more to the child they perceive than the child they have.
Yeah.
And they ignore any evidence to the contrary. Because Buffy literally says, you had your whole life ahead of you. That must be nice.
Yeah.
Totally ignores it. And, you know, I mean, it's still a moment between the two of them. But it's this and this the last scene that Travis was talking about is more of adults seeing their children more in terms of their role as daughter or student or whatever,
Slayer.
As Slayer, than seeing them as fully fleshed people with you know desires and motivations.
Yeah, Joyce has some fucking really whack parenting in this scene. I mean, I know it's like a sweet moment, but she makes two different anorexia jokes about her own daughter.
Yes, I caught that too. Like,
she like misses the point of her sadness, ignores what could have been read as like a suicide comment. Like, right? Like, this is just some straight up bad parenting. And she's proud. She's like directly proud of herself. She's like, see, sometimes mom gets it or something like.
I disagree for one reason. I am in the opposite cat of camp. So Joyce, so the problem with Joyce is she's not really well written. Okay. So, I mean, the problem is like emotionally Joyce is spot on in this like little scene. Emotionally, she's the only one who's emotionally getting her daughter in the sense that there's something terrible happening and that she wants her daughter to be happy and celebrate life and enjoy life. Emotionally, Joyce gets this, okay? She just doesn't know that Buffy's a Slayer. So it's that's like the whole, like the literal, like literally she doesn't understand this. But she actually, so she misreads like the idea of Buffy, why Buffy wants to run away. I think she really gets Buffy in the sense that she wants Buffy to live life. So I just think it's very frustrating right now that that Joyce is not in the loop and the writing suffers. Like she could have said so many better things here. And totally being someone who just screws up everything, screws up all the dialogue. I don't know. It's very frustrating. But
she does get her the dress, which is important. It's her like power dress. So, you know, story wise, she's not a bad parent. But like,
there's an important prop, right?
but she's like you. I don't know. I mean, literally, of course, it doesn't work out. But I still think that she's way more on Buffy's emotional level or the audience's emotional level.
That's a good point, Travis. And I think both can be true at the same time. That like,
she literally is wrong about everything, except she's actually right about some stuff.
That somebody can get you emotionally without having any idea what's going on. For me, that's
what this episode fails on.
Not really being helpful.
It emotionally makes sense and metaphorically makes sense. And anyways,
yeah, she's empathizing without understanding, I guess.
So we just finished talking about the scene with Joyce. So in the next scene, it's Willow and Cordelia walking through the hallway. This is really a sad scene that's set up, but Cordelia is upset that Kevin's not there. He didn't do anything. She's kind of bothered, but she's like, I'm really not bothered. It's kind of weird. It's just this amazing horror film setup. You know, something's really fucked up. Just the way that whole scene feels, because you're expecting Kevin to be working on something. If Willow's going to be involved or her be setting up AV, and that she's not. So like everything about the scene feels off. They go and walk to this like little room. Oh, he's watching cartoons. They look through the window. And then, you know, Cordelia opens the door and Kevin's dead at the door. There's five people killed by vampires and watching cartoons. And it's really twisted. They're showing like a Porky Pig dancing cartoon. There's blood stain on the television. And it's a total, like, it's just a total horror show. And probably, I think, the most effective death scene that we've seen on Buffy. Like, it's a really well put together scene. When we cut from there to Willow, I guess on the news we've learned, Joyce is like, Willow's been on the news. We're like, what? And then we cut back to Willow freaking out in her bedroom, like she really witnessed a tragedy. So it's a problem in the Buffy universe. Tragedies happen. We try and ignore them. This episode, at least, that really happened. Five people really got killed and we were really affected by it. And then it's a really weird scene because it also ends with, and this is a weird thing we can talk about later, this dress. Like, Buffy's wearing the dress, like she's going to go to the dance. Willow has, even though Willow's had this terrible tragedy, she's still like, you know, very positive person. She's like, I like your dress, Buffy, as Buffy leaves. So then we cut to the monster in his lair with the anointed, the kid. They're still plotting. And then to, you know, Giles with Calendar. They're talking about how the master's trapped in the Hellmouth and how Giles is going to go grab him. He's going to face him. So the master scene was just before is just remind us the master exists and he's a problem. Now Giles, he's like, look, you know, Buffy's going to die. I'm going to take him on. Buffy shows up and this is kind of our act break scene. You know, where it happens exactly is maybe contentious with me and John, but like Buffy's like, no, I'm going to do it. I'm going to accept the responsibility. You know, she was so totally devastated from seeing Willow. She's wearing her power dress. She's like, I'm going to go take them on. So she punches Giles, grabs a crossbow, and, you know, walks out.
And puts her cross back on, as I'm sure Dr. Frog would notice.
I'm glad you brought it up, because the symbolism, some say it's important. People are saying it. Can we talk about this?
I would love for that to be a quote on the box of any film. Symbolism is important.
The materiality and the physicalness of objects. There you go. You made me talk more. So I got to go back and just... What's happening?
Nothing. I'm just trying to move on.
No, let me go back for a second, because this is the scene with Buffy and Willow in the bedroom is basically it preceded major terrorist attacks in the United States by several years.
Whoa, where are you going?
This is a massacre at a school. It preceded Columbine, of course.
Right.
This is the social cognitive function we have. This is the world we live in the past 20 years. Willow, this is like Willow talking about the modern experience of being afraid of normal things. They didn't know it when they wrote it, but this is exactly, I'm not okay. I go to that room every day. It isn't our world anymore. They made it theirs. I mean, that's just that's like the most, you know, honest, quick summary of how you feel in a world affected by mass shootings, bombings, attacks anywhere, movie theaters anywhere in the United States and abroad.
Even at this, I'm surprised she ever felt safe in that room, considering this how many people have died this season. Like Buffy found a brain at one point, you know.
Recently, people have died. Yeah, I don't know why like this affects her so much, but five people die. That's a really powerful scene. And then Buffy in the bedroom with Willow is important because that's the moment where Buffy decides to actually fight. Okay, so Agnes is really important. This is the trigger. This is the trigger to make Buffy enlist, so to speak. You know, this is their own, like, this is like the moment that went too far. Like, I think she decided to accept the fate of I'm going to die for Willow because of this. And the second piece is, Dennis, how much does it cost to buy the rights to Porky Pig to play in your television show?
Well, this is WB, so nothing. Because it's a Warner Brothers cartoon, so it's free use.
Even though it was a Fox studio show, it was aired on the WB, and therefore they didn't have to pay the WB for licensing.
Okay. Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Okay. Great question.
Sorry.
Someone has to figure out these licensing problems.
Yeah, I'm just curious.
I guess that would be my area of expertise, I guess, licensing. I forgot about that. That's my job.
Patsy Cline, I Fall to Pieces. That's what Xander was listening to. And then Incredible by Jonathan Brooke. That was what Buffy was listening to.
There's definitely really interesting musical cues in this episode.
Yeah.
We could go into more detail about.
All right. Are we now talking about this stuff? I guess musical we are. Stuff?
No, I think we can wait on it because there's a couple really good ones in the third act that I want to talk about and stand out. So moving into Act 3, unless anybody wants any other Act 2 things.
Giles got knocked out. That's a drink. And she really wailed on him pretty bad. I wanted to ask Dr. Frog, how is Giles' brain doing after being knocked out as often as it is?
She hit him in the jaw, which there's a mechanism where you can just get knocked out by being hit in the jaw without really... Uh-huh. It's just like an automatic sort of like reflex that happens.
Really?
That's why, like, when you have a box, it doesn't look like they get hit that hard, but they get hit in a certain spot in their jaw, they drop. It's like,
oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, you don't have to literally hit someone on the forehead a bunch of times. But that's why it's a KO.
And when that happens, what are the odds of, like, permanent damage? It's like in the movies, I feel like people get knocked out all the time. Certainly in Buffy, people get knocked out all the time and they're fine. Is that how it is in real life?
No. No, there are consequences to getting hit on the freaking head so hard you get knocked out. I mean, Josh should be like confused. He could like not be able to like read for a while. I mean, that was a problem in a different episode, but he should have headaches.
He was in a nightmare.
Yeah. Talk about.
Okay.
I mean, he should have like some problems. I mean, obviously, repetitive brain trauma. We all know Muhammad Ali. There's, you know, traumatic brain injury, and, you know, Muhammad Ali was questioned about repetitive trauma causing, you know, Parkinson type problems. But yeah, no, huge problems. But so, anyways, I
guess. We have more medical questions coming up soon, so let's hold some of these for Act 3.
Yes.
So moving into Act 3, Buffy has a rad crossbow. She's walking across the high school, like the high school lawn, in her rad dress, her rad jean jacket, and this is like such a beautiful visual that like I'm shocked. I like this scene is so awesome, and it's like that last scene from episode 11 where Cordelia and Buffy are tied up on stage, like. It's not because it's super erotic.
Did you get an erection with this?
No, I just, it was like, it's a really rad visual. This is like
the
horror visual I want to see all the time. And it's crazy to me that scene is not in the opening like credits when they show rad scenes from the show. Cause it's like, that one was hidden from me. It's just
one of the
like
best scenes in the series.
It's the best visual in the series. I love it. So the gang is trying to figure out where, we cut to the gang, they're trying to figure out where Buffy is, but also, like, they don't know where the master lives. They haven't figured that out yet.
I feel like I want to know how Xander is even there, just since his phone is off the hook. How'd they get him?
Good point. Because there's a hint, there's implication in the last scene where we saw Xander feeling sorry for himself that maybe Buffy would go, like, someone calls him. Like, maybe it's Buffy, maybe it's Willow has called him.
No, yeah, it's definitely Willow.
Yeah.
Or maybe he saw Willow on the TV, and that's what made him put his phone back on the hook.
Oh, yeah, there was this terrible murder. Yeah, you
totally didn't massacre correct. At the local high school. I register on the radio as well. Yeah.
While we're at it, though, like, stupid question. How does Giles call Angel?
You don't think they exchange numbers at some point?
I think Angel
just I guess so, but, like, I got the distinct impression at some point that Angel does not live in a normal house. That he lives like in a sewer access room or something.
Oh my well, God. I can't wait till we talk about Angel's house. Because like and then, where people are and how they got there is really challenging in this next sequence here. Because like we don't know where the master is. Where did Xander come from? Also, how do we know where Angel lives? Apparently, everybody knows this shit. And if the vampires knew it, they would go and kill him.
Yeah, I also think Angel has a cell phone, probably, just based on other knowledge.
That makes sense.
Travis
has a 90s cell phone, but like, how does Xander then? And I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but how does Xander then know where Angel lives to go knock on his door?
Xander has never been to Angel's place. He shouldn't know where it is, but he knows.
Because I think this is answered in a missing story that we should totally write some exciting...
Called Xander Stalks Buffy for Days?
Some exciting Xander / Angel / fiction.
Man, there's definitely some / fiction potential.
Well, there's a lot, yeah. And I think that answers why he knows where Angel's place is, because he's been there. He has been there.
So he's not just looking at his neck, he's looking to neck.
Yes, the looking at his neck thing is super sick and is totally an indictment of homophobia. It's totally about how, like, you know, straight men are always like, why are you looking at me? That's totally what that scene is about.
So Buffy is in the sewers now with the anointed one, the little kid. He's, you know, she saw him. He gestured to her, follow me somehow. A lot of great silent acting happening here. The annoying one points and walks off, and Buffy goes into the sewers. Cut to Angel, Xander showing up at Angel's apartment to convince Angel to help him find Buffy and the Master, because Angel probably knows where the Master is. This is a weird freaking scene. Angel has a weird apartment. He's attracting all the weird shit in his apartment, particularly a jade statue in like a museum quality display. Like, I don't know. I know Angel's been around for a while, but this is so absurd. And Xander's trying to like connect with Angel about this issue about Buffy. They're both in love with her, and you know, she's loving Angel more than him, and they're gonna go find her. But there's this distracting massive jade statue.
It's the way it's lit, because Angel's house is like kind of like, you know, mood lighting, and then like the brightest light is on the statue.
Yeah, on the museum quality display.
We need to stop criticizing someone who has taste from another century.
Well, we can actually argue like he probably got it got it in China right as he got his soul. Absolutely. Probably he was finally able to appreciate art and was like, oh, I'm in China. This looks really nice. I'll take this for the rest of my life.
I don't think it was Chinese gypsies that cursed him.
All
that shit. That's a lot of shit to haul around. That's a big fucking statue to haul around your whole.
No, it wasn't Chinese gypsies, but he first gets his soul in China during the Boxer's Rebellion, right?
Oh my God, we're having so many timeline issues right now.
All
right,
so
Travis, I'm right though, right?
You're right, but kind of not in the way you're thinking you're right, but you're right. It's the Boxer's Rebellion in the early 1900s, but he got a soul actually in Eastern Europe, but then he did end up...
Oh, then he tried to pretend he didn't have a soul for a while, right? Yeah.
So you're right. You're right.
Oh man, can't wait to watch Angel to hear about that epic saga.
So, the scene is bad. Angel and Xander's. This is a horrible. I cut the scene.
It's a terrible scene.
I burned that apartment down. I mean, actually, I lived in an apartment that looked a lot like.
Why
that.
Why can't the screen just figure it out? Why can't Giles just call Angel on the phone?
No, he doesn't have a cell phone. No, the cell phone thing happens, but it's later, and he thinks about the lizards. It's complicated.
I just like the idea of them exchanging numbers at some point and Giles be like, let me write this into my address book, and like I'd watch that scene.
It's the classic Angel thing. He just shows up when he wants to and Giles lives at the fucking library. That's how he was there.
I like imagining the scene where Angel and Xander make out and he's like, let me write down this address where we just had sex in my address book.
So, we've never been to Giles's house, right? He does live at the library, right? There is a little.
He definitely has an apartment.
He has a house. We see it later on.
Oh.
It's an apartment.
No, he has a real house. It's a house.
It's got two floors, but it's an apartment.
Well, not,
it's in a complex.
We're jumping the timeline. We have not seen anywhere where Giles might live.
Yeah, he's homeless.
He's very concerned. He's wearing the same clothes every night.
Jenny is concerned about Giles.
So this Angel-Xander scene is terrible, but Xander does convince Angel because Buffy's in danger to go and find Buffy and save her. And Angel probably knows where she is. End of scene. Everything else is immaterial. There's some distracting shit in there. It is the source of all future / fiction.
Can we talk that they have very similar coloring and height? Like, they're pretty similar looking dudes. It's pretty... weird, just because the rest of the cast has more diversity of appearance.
It helps, the height helps with kissing.
Actually,
we've just talked about the Angel Xander scene. It's terrible. Then we cut back to the gang. They're in the library. How do they not know where the Master is yet? I feel like we've seen the Master a lot, but no one knows where it is. I guess we've only been there in a dream, even. They actually should know exactly where it is, but more on that at the end of this episode. Then we cut to Buffy confronting the Master. She's got her crossbow. There's some cool arrow grabbing, which is a callback, I think, to actually the Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie where this happens, where people are throwing things. And I think the lead Buffy in the film, she throws a dagger that's caught. I mean, maybe it's a callback, maybe it's not. But that was, that's visually what I thought of right away. And then there's a lot of cutting here. There's a lot of cutting to a lot of different adventures happening simultaneously. So... rather than go scene by scene, I'm just going to talk about the general flow of these scenes, and then they're going to flow back together. So there's the Angel Xander kind of rushing to save Buffy thing that's happening. Simultaneous to that, there is a Giles research scene where they're discovering that they need to go to the Bronze, because that might be where the Hellmouth is. I don't know why they need to leave. They need to go to the Bronze, because they make a decision to move back also. Then there are zombie vampires in the parking lot. Then we cut back to the scene with Buffy. Maybe this is less complicated than I'm making it sound. Come back to Buffy, and the Master is confronting her with the fact that prophecies don't tell you anything. And in fact, if she hadn't been there, he wouldn't be able to rise. And so her appearance is actually part of the prophecy, which I thought was really a good twist. It was actually a surprisingly good twist for this episode. So Buffy gets bitten by the Master. He escapes magically. I don't know how he was stuck the whole time, but he takes off. Xander and Willow are still on their way. So Xander so the situation with Xander and I'm sorry, not Willow, sorry, Xander and Angel is that Angel has no breath, so he can't give her CPR, but Xander is a living human, so he can. So we cut back to zombies, you know, these zombie vampires on the, you know, it looks like a football field or just the field in front of the school. Cordelia shows up. She saves them, and them is, you know, it's a bunch of female characters. Giles hasn't left.
Willow and Jenny.
It's Willow and Jenny, but I don't know why Giles isn't there with them.
He stayed in the library.
But why did Giles stay in the library?
He was
anyway,
he's continuing to research
the location of the this time. I'm shocked he didn't go to with Jenny and Willow. This scene is, there's too many cuts here. There's too much action taking place, so it's really confusing. But Buffy awakes. Then Cordelia drives to the school to get to the library. So we also escape from vampires who are zombies. There's some kind of snake creature in the library, this kind of weird serpent Hydra character that emerges. I guess it's just a snake at first. It's just a tentacle. Then Buffy says that she feels strong and different. What's, you're kidding me.
I didn't say tentacles. That's not a snake feature.
No, but
it's like a crazy monster.
It is definitely
a monster. There's a hissing noise when we first see it, so it's totally reasonable to think it's like snakes, but it turns out way bigger and Lovecraftian.
Thank you.
Which I want to talk about that later, about the Lovecraftian nature of this.
So now Buffy, she's revived. Resurrected. Revived.
Which is where I put the third act mark, but
That's a good place for it. I put it just before when she was dying, but like, yeah, this is kind of a fourth act now, like, you know, where she comes back. Like, I'm putting four acts here. There's this crazy tentacle monster that's like this is a Lovecraftian monster plus vampire zombies and lots of screaming happening in the library. And then Buffy kind of shows up. The theme music plays. She's walking toward the school. And then the theme music just dies as soon as she trips up a vampire. It really dies super abruptly. And it's like the rockin' theme music. Then Cordelia bites a zombie. She says, see how you like it. It's a vampire zombie. So it's not just a zombie. They're acting like zombies. They're not as smart as regular vampires. I don't know where these vampires are coming from.
And they seem super weak also.
Mm. Then Buffy kind of shows up on the roof where the master is reviewing his territory, like the roof of the library, which is the lamest rooftop you could ever be on, but he's still looking around like he's accomplished a lot. You know, getting out of his lair. Buffy shows up. She says, I may be dead, but I'm still pretty. Can't say so much for yourself. There's a lot of really funny lines that are completely delivered in the strangest way in this scene, which is like, oh, you've got fruit punch mouth. And like, just really weird, totally absurd lines here. So meanwhile, Buffy's fighting the master. Cordelia, Giles, Jenny Calendar, Willow, Xander are fighting this like Lovecraftian monster. Buffy throws the master through the now, you know, we have this new, like, she throws him through this glass structure on the roof. He falls through and, you know, he's killed. And then we walk through the school afterwards. There's a slow version of the theme playing, in piano version, a slow piano version of the main theme playing. And the Hellmouth is closed. That's kind of the end of the episode. They walk away, and the master's been killed. There's just a skeleton that remains. But the action is so intense, it's almost unfollowable. Like, you know that the Buffy versus the master thing has to happen, but as far as, like, how the, like, Lovecraftian creature is killed and how the vampires are dealt with, they're really not. It's just like, oh, you'll kill the master, it's all kind of dealt with. But it's a slightly unfulfilling scene, despite all the heavy action. Like, I want to see them deal with every one of these things in some way.
Yeah, I think they kind of just let you believe that the portal opening to hell, the Hellmouth, as they call it, the word escaped me, is like entirely tied to the master, right? So him dying is the key to it closing also.
Well, I guess because they do that one scene where they dip white, where the screen just goes full white, and then that's when the mouth opens, I assume. And then the creature, the tentacled creature kind of emerges.
It's confusing because there's a scene, there's a moment where Giles sees the tentacle monster and he says the Hellmouth, and it seems to imply that the tentacle creature is the Hellmouth somehow.
Well, I think it's supposed to be that the earlier Giles said like the Hellmouth will open and demons will overrun the earth,
right?
So this is like the first demon, Yeah. Which I want to talk about the fact that these demons are like Lovecraftian old elder ones. They're not like, they're not demons in the like, you know, Christian right. sense. I just think it's interesting that we're using Christian words, but we're meaning like hell, you know, when hell erupts, it's not fire. It's just terrifying monsters, right? Like we're meaning portals to deeper, darker dimensions, not Christian hell, you know?
No, so I love that. I like that it's not Christian hell. I like that it's doesn't seem like Christian hell, like from the creatures. I agree. I think that's a good choice.
Yeah.
Because Christian hell is pretty banal. I mean, you expect like, no, they open the hell mouth, right? Like there's this weird Lovecraftian demon, not just like, you know, like from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, not like
or, yeah.
Bogus Journey. You yeah. expect like Satan to emerge, like, whoa, I'm going to kill every, you know, like just a yeah. demon with horns, right? Like that's
yeah.
what you expect and it's not. Like,
yeah, I think that's totally interesting. I like that creature. That'll probably be the thing I draw from this episode, that beast.
I was expecting a lot more from the Hellmouth opening.
It happened
because I wasn't entirely sure it had happened because the prophecy didn't really come true exactly. It came true, but then Buffy came back. Like, I do want to talk about the prophecy part, right? Like, did they not read the rest of the prophecy? And I joked about that earlier, but it's like she dies. She totally like dies. She's dead, you know, like in like falling out of water. I mean, they're quite late to the scene. I think we're meant to.
Yeah, it's actually a pretty brutal death. I mean, her dropping is sad and like she looks like a dead body.
So I guess I clarified two things that unfortunately the episode didn't make clear. And I have a lot of problems with that scene with the Master and Buffy, that whole death scene.
I love that scene.
I have so many problems with that scene. But the two things I'll quickly say so you guys can talk, because I talked a lot, is they don't really clarify. So Buffy's blood, because she's a Slayer, is powerful, and that's the power the Master needed to get out. That's the first thing they didn't quite make clear. They said it kind of, but I've seen enough Buffy and Angel to let you know that when a vampire drinks blood from a powerful being, they get that power. And then the number two thing is, Angel technically, his problem is Angel actually does breathe because he's human. The actor is. So instead of saying, I don't breathe, because that's a little bit confusing, vampires technically don't breathe. But they should have just said, my breath can't give life, which is what really is also true. Vampires can't give life either by having kids or by breathing. Like their breath can't give life.
Unless it's prophesized.
But because they don't technically breathe, I just think they should have said, my breath can't give life, instead of I don't breathe. It's semantics. If people see David Boreanaz breathing, so that's why they're like,
I mean, he's talking, so obviously he has some breath.
Yeah, so just go with the canon that says vampires can't give life to other things. That's the canon.
So I just want to say, though, in a show that is usually quite heavy-handed with the rules and how things operate, for it to make up this totally different prophecy when Buffy arrives, which I think was cool, but also a really weird choice where it's like, hey, the prophecy is actually about you coming to me. And then also your blood opens the Hellmouth. Like, I did not catch that at all, that the blood opened the Hellmouth. I got that he became more powerful. He was very smiling, really big, like something exciting had happened. So I totally believe that something had happened, but that was part of the prophecy and that opened the Hellmouth. Like, that's all really like stuff they should have hinted at in an earlier episode. Like, they've got 10 episodes before this, or 9 episodes that, you know, between 1, 2, and 12 that really deal with the Master. And they didn't hint at any of this weird shit, except for the last episode, I guess 11. You know, they talk about the Codex a bit. But, like, this feels out of nowhere. Like, there's that episode, for instance, where they, you know, back in time, there's old-timey vampires, like, I'm thinking about iRobot Eugene, right? Where you've got this really older vampire with his old curse and shit, grabbing the computer, scan him in or whatever. Like, that tells me something weird about how vampires function. And this is a different type of vampire function happening. I expect something sacred to have to be read. Like, the Master is so obsessed with this freaking prophecy. Like, and he just like bites Buffy once, and then, you know, then it opens. I want something bigger for this scene. I'm happy that it's not. I do like that it's not. However, I think
stupid shit.
No, I do hate it. But watching the show, I expect something way bigger and more explicit than what I get. So, which is like, I'm happier with the result. I expect something very different than what we got.
I completely agree. This episode is like, it's at every possible opportunity, it sacrifices being clear about the rules and the mechanics of vampires for being accurate about the emotional truth of what's going on. Right. And so like it, the episode is spot on about how it feels to be the Slayer and has very confusing about what it physically means in any way.
So how does the revival work? Can we talk about that? So Angel can't revive her because of the vampire, whatever.
Right.
But Xander can be through CPR, supposedly. It can't be CPR, right? And this has got to be a special power that Xander has. He's able to revive her. She's dead. She's bitten by vampire. She's dead. Like,
why can't it be CPR?
The show makes it clear that she has been dead and is now alive. And she's more powerful and different. Something has happened to her that's different.
Yeah, she definitely leveled up, which is cool.
Yeah, which is cool, but like, I don't know. I actually think it's kind of appealing, the idea that in the face of the prophecies and the apocalypse, that what saves Buffy is something as mundane and pedestrian as CPR.
And that CPR didn't exist back when this prophecy was written, so they had no way of predicting it.
That's quite fun when you spin it like that. But they don't.
Yeah, there's something really appealing about that.
They don't joke about it when it happens.
No, they don't. But like, but I think it fits with the themes of the show that Buffy is sort of is split between these two halves, right? Of the, you know, the Valley Girl and the Slayer, and that on the one hand, it's the resurrection and she's the hero come back from the cave and all of this archetypal stuff that the show
is. They revived her way too quickly. I was disappointed with how quickly she's revived, because it's like she's dead for a second, if she's dead at all, and then she's revived.
And I agree. It doesn't have the pomp and circumstance that it could have had.
Like, but, in the Nightmare episode, she's buried underground, killed by the Master, and it's meaningful. She busts out. Here it's, you know, Xander, like, gives her CPR for a bit, there's a little bit of attention, and then she's revived in time to save us from the Master. Like,
I agree.
That's very convenient. And it fits with, you know, what this season needs to do is get rid of the Master, but like, she shouldn't win. The Master should win. I'm disappointed with their choice. They need her to win so badly that they're going to sacrifice the power of that scene of her being killed. It just felt like a very poor decision.
Yeah, I agree.
Can I talk about the Master scenes a little?
Please.
Because I think they're entertaining. I think, you know, I think it's interesting because he's just so different from the rest of the show. The rest of the show is like, takes place in the 90s, and he's like medieval monster. Like, the thing of Buffy walking from Sunnydale like into a different show completely when she goes into his lair. But he also does some really entertaining stuff, like when he's looking at his child, the Lovecraftian monster, and he does like this weird ass clap that's like not a normal human clap at all. It was so dopey. Like, he's not just sometimes he speaks in like, he's the only character in the show who like speaks in like crazy, like non-human ways, where he's like, how could you best me here when you couldn't below, right? Which then gives Buffy the chance to do the reverse of that, to like respond with fruit cup mouth. Mm-hmm. But then sometimes he does it also. He'll switch from being like glorious, glorious, to like to 5.1. Like like, I just think he's a funny character that I'll miss. He didn't get a great, you know, he didn't get a lot of action this season. He was trapped the whole season, but I think he's a cool villain. And I think it's totally interesting that they're opening up, like, that the world he's trying to create is filled with Lovecraftian monsters instead of, like, I don't know. It just, there's a lot there that is interesting to me that's not explored, really. But
no, I was totally expecting a monster to appear, like you're saying, like a Beelzebub, and have Giles name it. Like, oh, that's that demon from hell that crossed the angels or whatever. Like, that kind of hell, and it didn't happen. I was surprised. That monster, though, and we can talk about this in our best monster thing, like, that's a freaking amazing monster.
Yeah.
It's like the best designed monster in the show, and it's only in there for like a few minutes.
And it's nice and slimy and gross.
Yeah.
What a waste to spend that much time to make this amazing monster.
Did you notice how the tentacles were like veiny?
Yeah. You did a whole episode about that fucking monster. It's so cool.
Oh. And it really reminded me, and not in a bad way, in a good way, of
of the puppet at the very end of the Frank Oz Little Shop of Horrors.
Very similar to
that in many ways.
I think if I was going to say, you know, this whole season has been building up to Buffy and the Master, that scene. And it's okay. It's well lit. It doesn't last particularly long. It's got funny dialogue. My big problem of it is that the takedown of Buffy, like, so later on you see this much better. But Buffy, like, he drains her blood for like 2-3 seconds, which is not a lot of blood that got drained.
Hey, yeah, they could have done it longer. That would have made it feel worse.
Right. And so I liked kind of how he was you know, the sinisterness of the scene was good because of the way he was behind her and that she was this completely helpless. You know, this was cruel. This was dastardly. This was horrible. But they didn't stretch it out long enough. It happened in the blink of an eye, and then he tosses her unceremoniously into the water. To me, that character from another era, man, they knew how to do torture. They knew how to treat their enemies in a really bad way.
But he's so pumped about going up to the library roof.
Yeah.
The library roof! I do like that. I totally agree that the blood draining could have gone on a lot longer, but I think it's interesting that he just beats her so easily the first time. Like,
they chose to do that so that you could believe that she was revived, right? Like, it, like, they should have gone on longer, but they don't. Like, it's a second, right?
Yeah, and I think there's also probably issues with it being, like, with the network and everything of, like, can't gruesomely kill this character for 3 minutes. Like,
well, I'm not saying 3 minutes. I'm thinking maybe that there were issues with the censors. Maybe that you couldn't show a minor being brutally killed for longer than 5 seconds or 3 seconds. You know, I'm sure there were censor issues probably, too. But to me, that scene was way too short. And I could have given up so many BS scenes in this episode. But that's a scene I wanted. I could write slash fiction about this scene, but it's like, it definitely was not, it didn't satisfy a literal storytelling for me, or emotionally, that's not what the whole season has been leading up to. So I was frustrated. And maybe their hands were tied. So it's not a criticism of the writers or the director, but sort of this, maybe it's just frustrating situation.
There is some, like, frustrating directing and acting, like the scene right after that where she's like, oh look, a bad guy, and the music is playing. That should have been an awesome scene, but it just, like, the music just fades really quick.
Yeah, she just trips the guy.
Also, she just trips him. Like you could have just as easily done a different where she punches him and he goes out of the air, and then a different guy falls, and you'd be like, "Whoa, she's punching him so hard!" You know,
into the street. Like, it should have been like a Supergirl punch or
Supergirl. Yeah.
And then for the CPR, I mean, that's totally believable. The reason why is A, she really didn't lose that much blood. B, all she did was aspirate some water. It's not like she had a cardiac arrest. So all she did was had water. She drowned. She was. And she's 16, and she's the Slayer, and the water is cold. It looked cold, so you that's a totally believable.
So if I want to drown somebody and make sure they don't come back, hot water.
Yeah.
for the brain. All right.
It's bad for the brain.
Good to know.
So let's
drown him in the shower.
So let's go into this episode.
Wait, more medical question.
Oh, please,
Dr. Frog. I'm given to understand that in CPR that the breaths aren't as essential as we were previously led to believe, that they're helpful, but maybe not totally essential. Is it possible that, like, had Xander not been there, that Angel could have still revived Buffy with no breath?
That is an excellent question. Actually, it's, in some ways, it's conceivable, really, because it is, it's totally interesting. He probably did need to, knowing what we know now. He may not have needed, yeah.
If you're going to be, I think if you're going to be saving people, fighting monsters for a living, you should totally know how to do a CPR properly, right? Like,
yeah,
that seems really like a basic.
I just also found that
part of your job
knows like jack shit, and all of a sudden he knows CPR.
It's a high school class. Right?
Yeah, maybe he just got certified. This has been a weird podcast, guys. I think me being gone 3 weeks made it worse for me to speak at length. I forgot how we talk. I really like this episode. I will defend it. I know Travis doesn't like it. Like, I'm just so impressed that they can, this is what you can do in an hour of television, and nobody does it anymore. You can, within one hour, establish, like, the prophecy. She's going to die. You can have, like, the reaction to that. You can have the prophecy happen, and then you can have the twist on that. Like, I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm trying to write short stories. I'm done with, like, long stories for myself for now. And, like, just to see, like, that's what you can do. You can tell an entire story in a short amount of time. You don't have to draw it out over, like, so long. Like, I mean, yeah, there's some compression issues. But, like, this episode also, like, succeeds in, like, really establishing who the characters are again and, like, having them change within an episode. Like, it did a lot. It's a very good episode to me.
Yeah.
So, I like this episode also. It's not my favorite episode from season one. I don't know if we want to jump into our season review.
Just give an overall episode recap like Dennis did.
Oh, overall episode. this is a strong episode with a lot of interesting things happening in it. It's a little broken in places and unsatisfying. Based on the fact that it's the last episode in the season, and it's the only one that kind of continues the story of the season. So I already had my little rant, I think, about this episode in particular. It's the way it ends is really frustrating. This show can be so precious with its monsters and so precious with ideas, and then to like burn through so many in this episode so quickly is really shocking in a show that doesn't have a lot of monsters and ideas sometimes. Like, I feel like this feels like a season compressed. I know we said this earlier, but it's totally true. Feels like a whole season has been compressed into a single episode. All the character storytelling has taken place, and I'm ultimately unsatisfied with the result, which maybe is good because I want to watch season two. So, great job.
John, what do you think?
I think that this episode, I agree with everything that was said. I think this episode is basically a season compressed for all of the good and possibly bad things that might mean. But all of that stuff, all of the Buffy prophecy Slayer stuff, I've seen enough Buffy that to me feels like background noise at this point. And, you know, yeah, I know Buffy's a Slayer. I know what the challenges and the discussion of that was going to be like. So on recent watching, what really stood out to me was two things. First of all, the Xander plot through this was really interesting. I really enjoyed seeing Xander being rejected and seeing that the episode is not on his side with his feeling sort of alone in that. Like, we don't really feel a ton of sympathy for him. We don't hate him for it, but we don't really feel like, you know, we're not with him on it. And that was cool to see, what like I touched on earlier. The other thing that I thought was weird in this episode is there's some stuff going on with Cordelia and Cordelia's role in this episode is pretty ambiguous. So Cordelia has a new boyfriend, which is fine, but, her new boyfriend, there's a discussion in the hallway before they go to the AV room where Cordelia is kind of saying like, oh, he's being bad boyfriend, but I find it cute. And I have no idea what I'm supposed to get out of that. It's kind of just set up, but, maybe I think it's trying. Oh,
it's the apocalypse. It's the apocalypse. Like this would never happen, and now it's happening. Right? Like
right. But like, I mean, what am I supposed to? But so what? Like, why do I? Like, I don't know. I'm not clear what that is. I feel like there's a missing scene there somewhere. Like, I feel like if what we're supposed to get out of that is that Cordelia's growing as a person. She has a deeper relationship than she's had before, where she's willing to forgive somebody's faults. I need more to feel that way. If, on the other hand, what we're supposed to get out of this is that Cordelia is at the whim of this new boyfriend and she's actually just under his thumb and that's a bad thing, then I need more to support that. But either way, it's really confusing what I'm supposed to feel about any of that because Cordelia is acting out of character. We're not given anything about it, and it's really weird. So that was my good, my favorite and least favorite things about this episode. My favorite things, neither of which have anything to do with the main action. Like my favorite things are Xander's arc through this of like learning to play the supporting role without being the boyfriend, which is kind of cool. And my least favorite thing is Cordelia being, I don't know, doing nothing that made any sense.
I think me for this episode, my sort of like episode recap, I think for me, the best parts of this is the melodrama. For some reason, I don't really get caught up much in that, the annoying sort of mythology about the prophecy. It's interesting, but for me, it's the melodrama, and it's the melodrama of characters we don't normally care about. I mean, the Buffy melodrama, the Buffy dramatic events are amazing.
Well, Dennis okay. is gone because of probably his battery.
Battery down. But keep going, Travis. Yeah.
So the Buffy dramatic episode, basically summing up what the whole problem of season one has been. Then the Willow and Cordelia shine more brightly than Xander does in this episode. Cordelia, in a sense, because Cordelia's boyfriend is massacred. So she's gone through a bunch of trauma. We don't really like, that's not really brought up. But I think here is a turning point for Cordelia, you know, showing up, rescuing them, driving the car through the library. It's like this, Cordelia driving through the to the library in the car, it's like this amazing moment where she breaks literally into the Scooby Gang and like really breaks into our hearts. Like she's really matured at that moment. And then the Willow.
She knows how to drive.
Yes. Yeah. She's driving responsibly.
Does she?
Can I get through my little prepared remarks?
Sorry, Trev.
Anyways. And then Willow being seriously affected by mass murder and growing up and rejecting Xander. And that to me, her acting in those scenes were amazing. I think this is an incredibly strong episode. I know it's not my favorite episode, but I think it's a great, great episode. And they do so much, and then that always has a consequence. And so that, you know, the only downside of this episode is how much they do in one episode. That just leads to the only downside, and that's okay. That's okay. But overall, a great episode. I'm not sure how much I'm teasing out with whether or not Whedon. This is like Whedon's first that he directed. He wrote other episodes, but I believe this is like the first he directed in the season. But he allegedly wrote four other scripts or teleplays, either alone or with other people. So I'm trying to pick up, you know, Whedon's style from this first episode.
I mean, according to this, it's the first one he's directed. This is the DVD, like, little insert.
Yeah. So, but anyways, so that's my episode recap. You know,
stupid question. Where is the Hellmouth? Is it underneath the library?
That's what I took out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like literally is. Yeah.
So literally the master has been right beneath them this entire time.
The master was trapped in a church. That's different than being in the Hellmouth. The master was never in the Hellmouth. He was trapped in a church that collapsed during an earthquake. He opened the Hellmouth.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I just assumed he was directly beneath them the whole time. And that was kind of revealed.
No.
That's a fun thought, though.
Yeah, it's a cool
fun thought. Cool. It's what the show tells you by visual.
No.
Yeah, but he comes up somewhere else, sort of. Or does he?
Yes.
Yeah. Dennis is messaging nothing. Nothing.
Anymore. Okay.
So Dennis's battery is dead, which sucks. So should we do our full season recap another day? It feels like this is going kind of late. To talk about a full season.
We can do the season recap. I thought about maybe it's splitting it up anyways.
I mean, we could do that as a whole separate episode of the podcast.
Well, because I think we have all a lot of thoughts about it, and okay. It'd be a shame to end it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this has been fun. Really enjoyed this episode. Looking forward to season two. We'll, in the meantime, I think next episode was going to be a recap of all the excitement from season one. So we have a lot of different questions, which we didn't really get into about season two and, you know, what might happen, and also some season one, you know, general recap questions. So we'll get into those in our next episode.
All right.
Bye. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Thanks for listening. Reach out to us at BuffyVirgin.com in the comments section to talk more about Buffy. Anyway, thanks so much. Have a great week.